Streaming live 24/7. RadioInfluence.com.
He got him in the white trunks.
He heard him.
That's beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the top.
Whoa.
He's quick as a midget. And it's all over. It's all over. First round knockout.
Big
he's out. Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen, happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go!
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Welcome in to the first episode of the MMA Report podcast in the calendar year of 2018. Of course, I am Jason Floyd. We'll be joined here momentarily by Daniel Galvan. We're going to recap what happened last weekend at UFC 219. Also going to talk about what happened at Ryzen. Plus, we'll talk about James Thompson being suspended 1 year after failing his drug test. At Bellator 191, Mackenzie Dern making her UFC debut. So we'll talk about all of that. Plus, we'll answer some questions that were submitted to us via social media. Plus, later on in the podcast, I am going to have four interviews. Going to talk to Calvin Kattar about his fight coming up here later this month at UFC 220. Also, I will talk to Jason King and Shamir Peshewa. Of course, they both will be fighting on Saturday at Valor Fights 47. Of course, that will be on Flow Combat. And then my final interview is going to be with the man who's going to be fighting for a King of the Cage title here coming up next week, Blaze Gill. So all those interviews come up here later on in the podcast. But right now, I am joined by Daniel Galvan to recap everything that happened last weekend in MMA. Daniel, how was the new year for you?
The new year was quite fun, Jason. I enjoyed ringing it in, and I'm looking forward to do all my New Year's resolutions. I mean, do you have any New Year's resolutions, Jason, or are you one of those hardos that every day is the same?
I've never really been a big New Year's guy. I mean, I think, look, there are things I want to accomplish in 2018, yeah, but it's not like I sit there and sit there and go, oh, you know, I'm going to do this or do that. I think for me, it's more about the short-term goals. What are we going to accomplish in the next month as opposed to what we're going to accomplish in the next 12 months?
That's probably a more sane way to go about it instead of my goal of getting washboard abs. But who knows? I'm just happy because I tell you what, we talked about the Cyborg home pay-per-view buy rate maybe not being too high. But I will say, if you look at certain signs like Google searches, it appeared as though that pay-per-view on Saturday had a lot more buzz than I expected.
Leaning into Saturday night, I don't know if I really sensed a lot of buzz, but I can tell you, me and my buddy, we went out to Dave and Buster's here that just opened up here recently, and a pretty good crowd. The crowd did kind of thin out as the fights went on. I think part of that probably was due to the fact of Dave and Buster's is apparently 21 and up after 11 o'clock at night. But, you know, good crowd. The sports bar that I do marketing for, I got the text message on Saturday night that we had a really great crowd, which doesn't always happen. And I think a lot of that has to be about, the Cyborg and home fight. I think a lot of that has to do with Khabib and Nurmagomedov. We're going to get into Khabib because I think it's, you know, if the UFC is going to get behind any guy, I think they should get behind Khabib Nurmagomedov. But, I think as the fights are going on and after it happened, I did get a sense that there was a little more interest in the fight card than I thought there would be.
Yeah, and I did get a sense just talking to friends that people know who Cyborg Santos is. And obviously they are aware of who Holly Holm is. And to me, it's just a shame for Cyborg moving forward just because there aren't too many different challenges for her to test herself with. It's like for Cyborg, who looked so great. I mean, the vast majority of this fight played out on the feet, which is where Cyborg won it. And we can get into the scorecards. I don't know how you could put two rounds in Holm's favor. To me, this was Cyborg completely controlling it. But I get kind of sad watching the Cyborg fight because I'm like, she is so good. And by the time the featherweight division catches up to her, she'll probably be past her prime, you know, just because it's going to take quite a bit of time for there to be a long list of female featherweights at a high, high level. Right now, Cyborg Santos is just a cut above everybody else.
You know, the scorecards, and I'm glad that you brought that one up. you know, you have the judges that were scoring the fight were Derek Cleary, Dave Hagan, and Chris Lee. Derek Cleary had the fight 49-46. The only round he gave the Holly Holm was the second round. Dave Hagan and Chris Lee both had the fight 48-47. They had identical scorecards. Both gave the first two rounds to Holly Holm and then rounds 3-5 to Chris Cyborg. Now, if you look at the stats, now, personally, as I was watching the fight, Daniel, look, I'll tell you, I had some cocktails in me, you know, but I'm not, you know, once I started having the cocktails, I tried not to really break the fights too down hard on social media. But I thought 50-45 or 49-46 was the appropriate score.
Yeah, you know what? You could talk me into 49-46, but I just felt as though in each and every round, Cyborg Santos completely outlanded Holly Holm, completely outstruck her. And to me, Cyborg won where the fight mattered. I mean, there were quite a few instances where Holly, I guess, was controlling the body of Santos against the cage. But really, this entire contest felt like it was being played out exactly how Cyborg wanted to. And she was doing a great job of effective striking. Which, again, going up against a fighter with the quote-unquote boxing credentials of Holly Holm and a fighter that has showcased great highs with her kicks and her punching and some of her, you know, her hallmark wins over Ronda Rousey, I just feel as though this was just a complete shutout from Cyborg. And, you know, the scorecards, I wouldn't be surprised if down the line we do get a rematch just because, honestly, looking forward for Cyborg, there's only two challengers, right? It's Megan Anderson, who's being built up just because she is the best fighter at 145, not named Cyborg, and Amanda Nunes. And aside from that, there really isn't a whole lot to go on for Cyborg. To me, her future in the UFC is simply facing the very best female bantamweights that move up and take that super fight.
Before we kind of get into, you know, what's next for Chris Cyborg, let's look at the stats for this fight. And particularly, let's look at the first two rounds, the two rounds that two of the three judges scored for Holly Holm. And I think the only way you could say those rounds could go Holly Holm is you're basically saying, well, she had a minute of control in each round, which I still don't sit there. I mean, I don't know how you can score the first and second round for Holly Holm based on this. First round, she landed 5 total strikes and only landed 17% of the strikes she thrown were in reversal. Chris Cyborg, 20 total strikes, landing 58% of her strikes. And then in the second round, Holly Holm landed 18% of her total strikes, only landed 7 in comparison to 25 strikes landed for Chris Cyborg and at a 53% rate. And look, I know that MMA stats don't always tell the story, but I just, you know, and I saw a lot of people, these 48-47 cards, and I'm just like, I just don't see it. I thought that Chris Cyborg could win this fight. And you can sell me 49-46, but I thought this was 50-45.
Yeah, and as the fight progressed, it was just Holly Holm's gas tank became an issue, which is really crazy when you think about Cyborg Santos has now become almost the marathon woman in her weight class. Or in, you know, she is a fighter that you feel confident about in those championship rounds.
Yeah, that's a crazy thing. I mean, if you had told me that Cyborg would be the fighter that had, you know, the gas tank left in her and Holly Holm would not, I would not have believed you. I mean, that was a little bit of a surprising aspect for this, but I mean, look, it was a clear win for Chris Cyborg. She went out there and fought a great fight. I think it's a fight that, you know, a lot of people always wonder what happens if she goes 5 rounds MMA fight, what would it look like? Well, we now know what it looks like, but I think the unfortunate thing for Chris Cyborg is the UFC clearly is not trying to develop this division.
Yeah. And it's as simple as making fights happen, because it's not like you look at Megan Anderson and you say, well, this girl is a world beater. She's just a fighter who has had the platform of fights, and in comparison to every other featherweight, she's the one person people know. If the UFC really forced the issue and put on women's featherweight fights, signed women featherweight fighters, and tried their best to cultivate some type of division, it obviously wouldn't be the prettiest division. I mean, it probably would look pretty bad for a while, but if you make that initiative, I think the fighters will come. If you showcase a certain commitment to a weight class, you will either inspire people to train or have fighters bulk up or cut down. And it's for the UFC, as long as they're in the Cyborg Santos business, they're in the women's featherweight business. And if they're in the women's featherweight business, I think there's really an issue when it comes to not having everything in that division, having kind of one foot out the door. I understand the issue of lack of real talent at 145, but there are still fighters fighting in that weight class. And even if they may not be up to par with your women's strawweight or your women bantamweight fighters, I think you still got to put that spotlight on it, because without a doubt, although she isn't a superstar and she probably isn't a massive pay-per-view draw, Cyborg Santos is a fighter people know. She is also incredibly talented. And for if you're the UFC, you need to really treat each and every fighter you have on your roster that is a name wisely. And for Cyborg, what wisely means is cultivating legitimate challengers, because you can't just go about doing these fights with the very best at bantamweight, because it really hemorrhages two divisions.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I just kind of sit back on is, you know, when you're talking about who's going to fight Chris outside of Megan Anderson, we're talking about fighters who ultimately move up to 135 pounds, you know, Amanda Nunes, and we got a question about that we're going to get here shortly. You know, if I'm Chris Cyborg, and I think that, I mean, look, is she going to be a major pay-per-view draw? No, but the UFC has to find that women's fighter to replace Ronda Rousey, to replace Miesha Tate, because they're not walking back through the door. Ronda Rousey, you know, whether it's done or not, she's going to WWE. Miesha Tate retired. She just announced a pregnancy on social media today. So they have to do something to get that audience. And Chris Cyborg, to me, is the best fighter they have to potentially get there. But when you look at her next fight, and we got this question about thoughts about Amanda Nunes versus Chris Cyborg next over Megan Anderson, and will they actually build that division or keep cherry picking opponents to move up? And that was from Evil_ECCO. The last part of that we kind of talked about. I think you're just doing one off fights more than anything else when it comes to women's 145 pounds. We've seen Bellator struggle to create that division as well. You know, when you look at what they have done, you know, the Megan Anderson thing to me is, it's also, I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast. I know I talked to somebody else about it last week. The thing about Megan Anderson is there's this cloud of uncertainty around her and a lot of rumblings. And, you know, when she did that interview on Sean Wheelock's podcast last year about why she was not fighting at UFC 214, she really didn't answer the question. It was just this cloud of uncertainty. And there's a lot of rumblings out there of why ultimately she did not fight it at UFC 214. But to me, if I am Audie Attar, who now represents Megan Anderson, I don't throw her right into a Chris Cyborg fight. I understand as a competitor, Megan Anderson, that's what she wants. But if I'm in the management of Megan Anderson, I'm trying to get her a tune-up fight before she goes right in there against Chris Cyborg.
Well, it's a tough question to ask. It's a tough problem to have, because from a sporting standpoint, there's real value in getting inside the octagon and getting experience. But on the flip side, if you're advising somebody, there's real value in just taking the money on the table when it's right in front of you. Because doing that tune-up fight puts you in a spot where you could, in fact, lose and then lose the opportunity where the biggest payday would be the Cyborg fight. So I would put it there. Now, the flip side of that flip side is that women's featherweight division is so shallow that you could lose a fight and eventually get a title shot anyway. So that is the deal there. And even from the promoter's standpoint, what you're doing next, I think you could do Amanda Nunes versus Cyborg next, and that may in fact be the best fight to do, because Nunes Cyborg is the best, the biggest fight you can probably do in the women's division right now. I'm going to be real interested to see what the buzz will be like for Joanna Rose too, but Nunes Cyborg to me is a pretty big fight, a fight you could main event a pay per view with, and potentially do 250,000 buys. I think that's pretty solid for a non superstar at this point. The way the pay-per-views are going, you could do that. And the value there from the promoter is just getting people aware of who Megan Anderson is in another spot to give her a bit of a push, because at this point, Megan Anderson is a name that people have heard. Cyborg has mentioned her, but I'm sure not too many people have seen her in Invicta fights. There's real value in putting her on potentially the exact same pay-per-view that Cyborg's next title defense is on a main card, and just have her on the earlier on the main card, and then the main event being the Cyborg Nunes fight. And if Nunes loses, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world. I think she still has a lot of respect, and she could go back and defend her 135-pound title against Raquel Pennington on the back end of that. So that's the direction I would go with, Jason. Cyborg Nunes, give Megan Anderson a fight where she'll likely win. Allow Megan Anderson to see, get some eyeballs on her, and you can book Anderson versus the winner of Nunes Cyborg. And it very well could be Amanda Nunes.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about, you know, Amanda Nunes, she, you know, back in May of 2017, she kind of talked about that she didn't seem that real interested in fighting Chris. You know, she mentioned about the weight difference and how she would have to change her training. You know, Chris is, you know, I would say over the past 3 or 4 months has come out and talked about she weighs about 175 pounds and cuts down to 145 pounds, which to me is kind of amazing that that's the amount of weight that she does cut to make 145 pounds. I mean, if I'm the UFC, Cyborg Nunes is a fight to make. But my gut feeling is Cyborg Megan Anderson will be the co-main event of UFC 221.
Where's the UFC 221 card at?
That would be Australia.
Yeah, I mean, that obviously an Australia card is where you would want to put Megan Anderson. And Cyborg has shown a real, like, she's gung-ho about making that fight happen.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, you know what? I could certainly see that. I guess they already have a poster out of Mark Hunt, Curtis Blades as the co-main event, which, you know.
I don't think they've come out and officially said that's a co-main event. I mean, it was that's one of those fight cards that if you look at it right now, the way it sits on UFC.com, you're mm-hmm. sitting there going, man, that fight card needs some name value. I mean, look, Whitaker Rockhold is a great fight. You know, Blades Hunt, clearly it's, you know, a main card fight, but outside of that, that's a tough draw to get people to drop $60.
Yeah, and maybe that's the strategy you can go with Cyborg, is you kind of interchange the whole deal of one pay-per-view, you try and really give her her best challenge, and you allow her to headline that show. And you sink or swim on the buy rate. And you follow that up by stacking her in a co-main event slot on a bigger tent. And she can help put up that tent, because you're right, she would add the depth of this card sorely needs, because Hunt Blades is really the only other fight is the only fight I see on this card that is interesting at all, other than Ben Gwynn and Juicier Formiga.
Yeah.
But neither of those two fights are bringing people to the TV. I think Cyborg would, for sure. And putting Megan Anderson in her home country is always kind of like an added bonus. And that to me is what would work well. That is a quick turnaround for a fighter who fought for 5 rounds, even if she didn't get beat up too bad. So, yeah, that's a solid prediction, just because the more you do look at this card, this is a card that's missing hopefully only 3 more fights, although it's probably missing 6 more fights. I really enjoyed the 10-fight fight card, Jason, I tell you that much, especially for a fight card in UFC 219 that had very few finishes. This was a very long card to get through, but imagine if this was like 12 or 13 fights long.
Yeah, a lot of decisions. Holly Holm, since knocking out Ronda Rousey back in November of 2015, is now 1-4 in her last 5 fights. The only win was a knockout against Betcha Cahaya. The loss is Misha Tate, Valentina Shevchenko, Jermaine Day, Armando, and now Chris Cyborg. I mean, look, I expect she's going to return to 135 pounds. You know, she makes a lot of money. It'll be interesting to see how the UFC books her in her next fight.
Yeah, I think she's got to be rebuilt, and I think she can be rebuilt to challenge for the Bantamweight Championship. She's a name. There's value there. Women's Bantamweight, I would say Holm, Amanda Nunes are probably the two names in that division. There really isn't anybody else that I can think of that maybe Juliana Pena. But even Valentina Shevchenko isn't necessarily a name quite yet. So there's a lot of value in Holly Holm, and I think it would do the UFC real well to put her on the slow track, because she has had quite a few opportunities lately. And The next time we talk about Holly Holm, it should be more like she has a 3-fight win streak instead of she's won one fight since 2006. You know, yeah. I she's faced some of the toughest female fighters to ever put on a pair of gloves. So I think for Holly Holm, it's pretty simple, Jason. Put her in a fight where she's a minus 250, minus 300 favorite. And that's pretty easy at women's bantamweight. So I think that's what you got to do. And for Holly Holm, I mean, her next fight is incredibly important. Because if it is a pretty big mismatch and she comes out and fights that fight really close or doesn't dominate or even loses, then it becomes the writing's on the wall for Holly Holm.
Yeah, they've got to rebuild her up. Now, the co-main event, best performance Khabib Nurmagomedov has ever had in the UFC?
Yeah, it's real shocking, real surprising. I didn't see this one coming. I thought Nurmagomedov was going to show signs of ring rust or signs of being tentative against such a dangerous striker and a guy who has spent his entire career fending off takedowns. He has plenty of experience, does Edson Barboza, not going down to the ground, but that's what Nurmagomedov did. To go up against one of the best lightweights in the world in Barboza and dominate him in 30-25, 30-24 fashion, this was a statement by Nurmagomedov. And Nurmagomedov and both Tony Ferguson have both made statements. And it's unfortunate that you see these performances and the elephant in the room is obviously Conor McGregor. But I think it's safe to say that if you had to bet your life on who is the best 155-pound fighter in the world, Conor McGregor may get the third most votes. I think you could see a lot of people, given what we've seen lately, that to think that Tony Ferguson and Khabib Nurmagomedov is going to be a fight to determine the best lightweight in the world. Khabib had plenty of questions heading into this one, Jason, and not only did he answer them, but he far surpassed anyone's expectations, and he may have swung the odds in his favor when the betting odds come out for a Nurmagomedov-Ferguson fight.
And speaking of Conor, tweeted on Monday saying, quote, "That Dagestanian was dog shit the other night. You are all nuts. Game full of sloppy bums asking to be slept. Pay me my worth and King's back." Now, obviously, the last part of that is basically telling the UFC, pay me what I'm asking for and I'll be back inside your cage, which, you know, one of the things that I'd always heard over the past couple weeks was the UFC really wanted Conor McGregor back March 3rd to headline UFC 222. Does not look like that's going to happen, but you know, who knows? Look, Conor McGregor is the biggest star in this game. The UFC needs him. There's no question about it. When looking at, and I tweeted this on Saturday night, I would love to see Khabib Tony Ferguson from a sporting aspect. I mean, it's a fight that, you know, we talked about it in March of last year when it was scheduled to happen. It's a fight I really want to see. However, if I am Tony Ferguson, I'm waiting for Conor McGregor because that's a life-changing fight financially. You know, Khabib Nurmagomedov, great fight. It's not a life-changing fight. It's just another UFC fight from a payday aspect. And also the advantage that Tony Ferguson has in this, he's represented by Audie Attar, who also represents Conor McGregor. So Tony Ferguson has a little inside info on how close we are to seeing Conor McGregor back inside the cage. So from a financial aspect, if I'm Tony, I wait. From a fan and sporting aspect, God, sign me up for Tony Ferguson, Khabib Nurmagomedov.
Yeah, as a fan, it gets annoying. It really does, because all Conor McGregor ever talks about is like how much money he has and how much they need to pay him. And at the end of the day, you're a fan and you just haven't seen the fighter fight in a year and a half. You haven't seen a championship defended in a year and a half. And the romanticism regarding the sport for such a long period of time is champions fight the best fighters. And at some point, Conor is going to kind of like he is no longer a necessary part of the machine. He is a very nice part of the machine. In fact, he may in fact be the greatest part the machine has ever had. He may be the biggest draw the UFC has ever had. But at the end of the day, Conor McGregor is only fighting one weekend out of the year. And every other weekend, MMA fans have to watch somebody else fight. So I would say the biggest money fight is Conor versus anybody. But if you're the UFC, I think take away the title from Conor. If he's not going to defend the title, make Tony Ferguson and Magomedov for the legit championship and just take it away from Conor. Like, it's as simple as it would be nice to do the phenomenal buy rate, but that's just one single fight. And for Tony Ferguson, that is life-changing money. You can't make the case that it makes any sense for him to take the Nurmagomedov fight. But as a fan, it just gets tiring because for Conor, the only person that benefits from Conor holding out for a big payday is Conor McGregor, just because as a fan, it's like, I kind of just want to see the fighters fight. I'm a big fan of the fights, not the tweets. So look, it just gets tiring.
They're not stripping Conor the title. Let's stop this talk. Like, if you think the UFC is going to take away the UFC lightweight title from Conor McGregor, I don't know what to tell you. He's the biggest star in the game. They need him financially. So it is not in their benefit to strip him.
That's true, but you gotta, like, at some point, you gotta have events. Like, you gotta have contests.
If we are in July of this year and there is no title defense coming, I think at that point, it's been a year and a half. Okay, at some point, you just have to do it. But right now, the UFC is not going to do that. They want to get Conor to a contract because there is no one in that company that brings the kind of revenue that Conor McGregor brings. And, you know, and my view on this, I think, is a little different than a lot of people just because of the marketing that I do for a sports bar. I can tell you, Conor McGregor, there is no one that draws the audience that he does.
Oh, without question. And I think it's fairly it's possible that he could literally be the biggest draw the sport's ever seen. Which is crazy because things always go up and up and up and up, but it's really crazy high peak that he achieved. And if you're the UFC, you're in the Conor McGregor business no matter when he shows up, but it's like you might as well give your welterweight championship to Jesus Christ. Like, he would be a big draw if he ever comes down and fights with the UFC, but if he never does, I mean, you never have your welterweight championship defended. There has to be a timeline, and it's probably got to be late summer. You're probably right.
Yeah.
This is a major bargaining point for Conor, and you're going to see a lot of pump fakes, basically, of like, ooh, we don't need Conor, or ooh, I'm going to just retire. But this is the most important point the next 2 months if Conor will ever fight again, which he probably will, and he probably will fight somebody else.
They need Conor. Anyone who says the UFC doesn't need Conor.
But here's the thing. I would vacate the championship and just have him fight George St. Pierre.
Oh, no. Yeah. Financially, yeah. I will say this, and maybe people will agree with me. Maybe you will. Maybe you won't. I think the tougher fight for Conor McGregor is Tony Ferguson.
He's the one guy that can stand with him, and you feel good about his stand-up.
I commend Khabib for his fighting style. I mean, the way he was just coming straight at. But I think if he comes at Conor McGregor that way, he's going to sleep.
Yeah, Conor, I mean, we haven't seen him fight in forever, but, like, he has scary quick knockout power. So it's like 3 seconds and you're out, hypothetically. But if Khabib doesn't get finished, like, in the first 25 seconds, man, that first round is going to be his. And then if he doesn't get finished in the first 10 seconds of the second round, that second round is going to be his, because what he has shown and what he showed against Barboza is once he gets a hold of you, you are in hell. I mean, it is hell to get up. It is hell to stay where you are because it hurts like hell, but it's practically impossible. So it's a thing where Tony kind of matches up where you feel solid about his stand-up going toe-to-toe with Conor, and he should be comfortable there. There's an enormous gap between Conor and Nurmagomedov's stand-up, but the difference is with the McGregor-Ferguson is for the entire round, you know the fight may in fact play out on the feet. Conor has a chance to win every second that it fights there. For Nurmagomedov, there's precious seconds early on in the round where Nurmagomedov is super vulnerable. But once those pass, Khabib can just dominate him. So that's kind of the matchup differences. You know, I think Conor's best chance at victory would be a GSP fight, though. Like, I actually think Nurmagomedov has a better chance of beating McGregor than St. Pierre, even though St. Pierre is much bigger.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I would love to see Khabib to Conor. I think it'd be very interesting, but I would like Conor's chances more against Khabib than against Tony. Because I think Tony's just a well-rounded fighter. I think there is still I thought we saw improvements in Khabib's stand-up game, but I also think there's still some holes there.
There just isn't enough time in the world for Nurmagomedov to catch up with either of the two on the feet. Now, there is enough time in the world for either of the two to catch up with Nurmagomedov's wrestling. That's important to note. I do think headed into this fight, Ferguson was, to me, a big favorite in a hypothetical Nurmagomedov – not a big favorite, but a favorite in a hypothetical Nurmagomedov fight. But this performance really closed the gap in my mind. Nurmagomedov really looked dominant, and I don't think Ferguson would be able to, in a fight against Nurmagomedov, really defend his takedowns all too well. I think Ferguson, out of anyone at lightweight, would be the best when it comes to once the fight's down, surviving or throwing up submission attempts. But I really thought that this performance under Nurmagomedov kind of colored in more details about how great he is. His stand-up did look improved, Jason, but again, you're right. Simply put, standing up, he is just not in the same league as Ferguson or Connor, even with the improvements. But again, neither Connor and Tony both are in completely different leagues when it comes to how great Nurmagomedov is with his grappling.
Let me ask you this, if you had the same thought I did. When the second round ended, were you questioning Mark Henry in that corner of why they were having Barboza go out there for the third round?
Yeah, I get you. I get what you're saying, because at the third round, you're talking about Barboza can't even outstrike Nurmagomedov because he's so tired and beat up.
He was a beaten fighter.
It was something we see a lot, and there really isn't – we never see corners take fighters out of these fights. I don't know when the first time will be. I'm sure it's happened once or twice before, but that's just not a part of the culture. Now, should the culture change? Probably, right? Mm-hmm. Because all he did was go in there and take more and more damage. He wasn't going to turn it around. It was just a foregone conclusion. So I think the fight probably should have been stopped, especially with the obvious benefit of hindsight. But in a sport where the training is so severe and there's such a macho aspect of the culture, I don't think we'll ever see corners stop fights like that.
Here'd be the question. If the pay was not based on the fact that if you win, you get double the paycheck, if it was just everyone just got a guaranteed rate, I think we would see more corner stop fights. But maybe I'm wrong, but I feel that because of the way the structure is of a win bonus, is that's why a lot of corners have their fighters go out there just in case somehow they could pull a Tim Bosch off.
Yeah. Well, it really, at the end of the day, their pockets get a little fatter if the fighter wins. And it's that. And I mean, growing up, every person who likes fighting romanticizes over the Rocky ending where you get, I mean, not Rocky one, obviously, but, you know, Rocky, Ivan Drago Rocky, where you get destroyed for a long time. And then you come out in the last round, and you score the crazy knockout. It's this romantic ideal of getting destroyed, beat up, and you still manage to win the last second. And you always have a chance to win, even though you really don't, or you win once in 1,000 times. So it's just something that I think will never stop because you have the financial incentive for corners to not stop it. And then emotionally, it's hard to tell a fighter, you don't have a chance to win this fight anymore. We're done. Yeah. Because they sacrifice so much for those moments. So the more I think about it, the more I'm okay with it. There are cases where there's a clear line. Barboza was right on the line. You know, to me, the clearest case is some of the beatings that Cain Velasquez used to do on people, where it was like, it's a no-brainer.
JDS's corner, do you not care about the guy?
That, to me, is the one where that's the clear standard of when a fight should have been. A corner should have stopped the fight.
God, I just remember those fights, watching him, and like, you want to turn the TV off.
Yeah.
You're just like, it's just one of those times where you're like, God, does no one in his corner care about his well-being?
Yeah, and it's also like his opponent is such a dangerous fighter. Like Francis Ngannou could be a fighter like that, where he is so scary that you're going to feel unsafe or you're going to feel gross watching him destroy people if they don't get finished, you know?
Let me ask you about Ngannou quickly. Don't you feel like there's a lot of people that have just like already crowned him as the new heavyweight champion?
Yeah, poor Stipe, man.
Do people forget how good Stipe Miocic is?
Yes.
Like, if I'm a gambler, And I'm sitting in Las Vegas for UFC 220. I got to be loving the way that everyone is talking up Ngannou, because you're going to get great value on Stipe Miocic. I mean, right now, Stipe Miocic is plus 165.
That's insane.
That is an insane number to me. I mean, look, I know we live in the moment, and we all saw what Ngannou did. And look, the guy has massive amount of power. But I think a lot of people have forgotten how good Stipe Miocic is.
Yeah, well, he has less questions about the well-rounded nature of his mm-hmm. game and the physical aspects of maybe cardio, etc. I mean, Ngannou has the highest upside, and he has the greatest strength. It's a great fight, dude, but he shouldn't be an underdog. Stipe should not be – I mean, I don't know who should be an underdog, but it probably shouldn't be Stipe. If you have a lot of money, you watch this sport, you watch each and every event, Miocic kind of stands out as the slight favorite in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of people that kind of believe that Ngannou can have this Mike Tyson aura to him, and I think a lot of people are just so enamored with that and trying to build the next star, but to me, a lot of people have forgotten about Stipe Miocic. But back to 219, in terms of the rest of the fight card, there is one guy that I will single out that I was extremely impressed with his performance. And that was Matthias Nicolai getting the decision win over Lewis Smolka. Was just super impressed with his performance. Kudos to John Anik on the broadcast for mentioning that this was his first fight since coming off USADA suspension. I thought that was great clarity to have in the broadcast. I mean, Lewis Smolka, you know, showed his tough durability, but Nicolai, that was just a tremendous A-plus performance.
I'm glad you mentioned him, because that's who I was thinking of too. I mean, to me, the first two fights of the card showcased really great performances out of lighter weight guys.
Yeah.
Tim Elliott showcases high level grappling against a tough fighter, Mark De La Rosa, who flashed high. And if you talk about future champions, Nicolau is the guy who stuck out, because he took on a really tough fighter in Lewis Smolka, dominated him in every aspect. And the thing with Nicolai is his stand-up to me sticks out as like he was just at a different level. He was just fighting. It was just like he was a step ahead of Lewis Smolka, and he knew everywhere Smolka was going to be, and he was going to beat him to the punch. And then his grappling also was real nice. So, yes, Elliott and Nicolai to me were the two fighters that impressed me the most. Now, I think we have an obvious answer, Jason, for who was the most disappointing fighter, right? Carlos Condit. Against Neil.
Yeah, that's got to be up there. How about Joe Rogan on the broadcast calling out Khalil Roundtree for being a 90-second fighter?
Yeah, I tell you what, Khalil Roundtree is another great answer, because he got outstruck by Michael. I got to learn how to pronounce his name.
I will tell you, really this. Good. I was looking at the DraftKings lineups and the price values, and I was like, man, Michael O, because I'm going to tell you I can't pronounce his last name. I was like, man, if you're looking to build a roster, I think he was like 6,800.
Oh, my God.
Which I was like, man, you know, which obviously you knew if he could somehow survive a flurry from Khalil Roundtree. But yeah, you know, Roundtree, Condit, you know, I think I give a lot of credit to Neil Magny in that fight. Me and my buddy, as we were watching the fights at the bar, we did get a good chuckle when they announced the scorecards for Esparza and Carvillo. And I was like, oh, Carlo won this fight, you know, 2-1. I don't think many people would doubt that. And it was like, and Cynthia Carvillo's reaction when she lost the fight was just classic. You know, like she, you know, it's almost like, did no one in her corner tell her, like, hey, this may not go your way?
Yeah, I mean, to me, the most decisive round probably was the first round for her in her favor, but Jesus, she came across as like entitled, almost. Like she was entitled to become the women's strawweight savior in the next Ronda Rousey, riding Dana White's private jets. Like, Jesus, chill out, dude. You lost the fight. I mean, last two rounds were close, but Carla outstruck you. And look, Cynthia fought a really tough female strawweight in Carla Esparza. I think Kavila's going to get back. She's going to get solid victories, but she's got to kind of not believe her hype too much just because it doesn't do her any favors. But yeah, that was just a bad look out of Kavila. Michael, oh man, we got to learn how to say his name, because this dude is good and he's young at light heavyweight. Like, Khalil Roundtree isn't very good, so it's always, it's, you know, it's hard to figure out how good Michael O is, but he's won quite a few fights in a row. He's 22. He's in 205. Jeez. And then that Dan Hooker, Mark Dye, Kesey fight sucked so bad. Oh my gosh, those two rounds were so boring. Marvin Vettori, Omari Akhmedov to me was the fight of the night. Even though it didn't win it, I really enjoyed it. It felt like two big old brutish middleweights just trying to outstrike each other.
And I'll tell you, when I talked to Marvin, he, you know, I don't, the way that fight played out and the way he told me he thought it was going to play out, two totally different things. He thought Omari was just going to double leg him all fight long, that he wouldn't stand with him. And Omari made great striking he showed off in that fight. Yeah, I enjoyed watching that fight. So that is UFC 219. Of course, the next UFC fight card comes up on Sunday night, January 14th in St. Louis, headlined by Jeremy Stephens and Du Ho Choi. But also this past weekend, we had Ryzen. If you stayed up in the wee hours of the morning to watch that fight card, of course, Koji Horiguchi ends up winning the tournament there. Knockout in the final round. Also, Krokop got the win. And Gabby Garcia did not fight due to missing weight.
Yeah, this was a total Japanese MMA card, man. But not really. Like, this was like the bad kind, sort of, because the positive side was Kyoji Horiguchi. This was just a lights out weekend out of him. They had two events, and the positive side was Kyoji Horiguchi won three fights against tough fighters, beating Shintaro Ishiwatari, and in the final, piecing together several finishes. And also, you had Mirko Krokop take out Kosaka in like a minute. That fight was kind of an embarrassment, and Krokop announced that he would retire next year on December 31st. So that's cool to look forward to. But you also had the bad side for Ryzen. I mean, Takanori Gomi had a loss, although he looked okay for like the first minute against Yusuke Yaki. But the biggest problem for Ryzen Fighting Championship, Jason, is if you ask anybody what they heard about Ryzen this weekend, this was their big event. It was the Gabby Garcia mess. To me, that was the big storyline. And if you're a promotion, you don't want a fighter missing weight to be your big storyline. But not only a fighter missing weight, but the fact that she was taking on a 53-year-old and the original difference in weight was like 40 pounds. And then she went and missed like 26 pounds. And then she had to apologize in the ring. This was an absolute Japanese MMA in 2017 cluster F. I mean, this was embarrassing. Mm-hmm. This was bad. This was really like a negative outing for Ryzen Fighting Championship, because they have one of the best bantamweight flyweights in the world in Kyoji Horiguchi, and he came out here and was overshadowed by Gabby Garcia.
Yeah, it's you know, and then of course, you know, the Ian McCall with that, with him, that became a storyline. But I did feel, and let me get your thoughts on this, I do feel like there's a lot more interest in Ryzen right now than a year ago.
A little bit, yeah. Tab, because they are signing really good fighters. You know, Kyoji Horiguchi is just a great, great hire, and he's not the only one. They are bringing in some names. It's nice to see Mirko Krokop get his hand raised. I mean, he's pieced together a nice win streak. And that's kind of why I'm more disappointed in the Gabby Garcia thing, because there are some nice things going on with Ryzen. And I believe, well, firstly, I believe this. I think there's a pretty big resurgence in the Japanese professional wrestling scene. And I believe that works in that, that can work with MMA at the same time. I usually think a rising tide will raise every ship in combat sports in Japan. So with the wrestling scene in Japan moving upwards, I think there's room for a Japanese mixed martial arts scene to have a lot of success moving forward. Ryzen represents the best possible promotion for that success to take place in. So that's why I'm optimistic about Ryzen. So we shall see what the year brings in.
In terms of some other things we wanted to bring up here before we get into the interview portion of the podcast, two MMA news items to mention. James Thompson has been suspended 1 year after failing his drug test at Bellator 191. Of course, I reported this story. One of the questions I did get after it was basically, you know, will commissions honor this? And since it was a commission suspension handled down by Mike Mazzulli, we'll go into the MMA database. So it will be a 1 year suspension for James Thompson. I don't think a lot of people were shocked by this drug test, but once again, it shows that there is drug testing going on in Bellator. You know, is there enough drug testing going on in Bellator? No, but there is some going on in Bellator, especially when it's events regulated by either Mike Mazzulli or Andy Foster. And then on Monday, a video came out that revealed that Mackenzie Dern is set to make her UFC debut, and it's going to be at UFC 222 in March against Ashley Yoder. And when I put this video out there, got a lot of feedback. And a majority of the feedback was, is Mackenzie Dern rushing it to the UFC? And, I mean, obviously the only one that would probably really know the answer to that question would be John Croucher, head coach. So if he's on board with her, you know, taking this fight in the UFC, to me that tells me that they believe she is ready.
Yeah, I think the Ashley Yoder fight realistically could have happened in LFA or Invicta. So the initial fight isn't too worrisome. The challenger doesn't represent a dramatic upswing in opponent quality. But if Mackenzie Dern gets a win or two, she will likely be out of her league just because her striking currently doesn't appear up to par to the best in her weight class in the UFC, which makes sense for a fighter who made her professional debut in 2016. She probably is rushing a bit too quickly, Jason, but money's money. And if she does fail, it's something where it's going to be up to her mentally how she deals with those early failures, and that's going to be kind of the big separator of whether or not Mackenzie Dern becomes a champion, is how she deals with losses, because they're inevitable, I would say. But she obviously is a fighter who has a lot of upside, both as a draw and as just her skill set, her foundation of grappling is really at a high, high level. So I'm a big fan of the signing, and I look forward to seeing Mackenzie Dern kind of get promoted by the UFC and see how that takes off, because she does represent one of the best cases for potential when it comes to the next stars the promotion can have.
Last thing I want to talk about here, got asked by at Guz Congo about wanting us to play matchmaker. Who would we like to have fight for each title in the UFC and Bellator this year? Now, the way we're going to take this is whoever the current champion is, who we'd like to see them fight. Let's start off in the UFC at flyweight. Demetrius Johnson, this is an interesting one just because he's literally beaten everyone top in the division. You know, I think the TJ Dillashaw is a fight that makes sense, but I'd rather see that happen at 135 as opposed to 125.
Yeah, I would. That's actually a fight that I would love to see. That's the fight I would want to see the most, really. I went like towards the end of the year, a guy who gets a shot at Demetrius Johnson. I may have overthought the question, but I just went a fighter I want to see kind of get a couple wins and then get the title shot would be Alexander Pantoja. That would be the fighter towards the end of the year. Mm-hmm. If he wins the right fights, he kind of showcases a lot of hypothetical upside, because Jesus, you look at 125, Jason, and all you see are rematches.
Hey, look, if Ben Wynn wins at UFC 221, he gets in that conversation.
Yeah, he does. And it really is a benefit if your sure dog results profile doesn't have Demetrius Johnson in there.
Yeah. At 135, mention about TJ Dillashaw. I'll go a different route with him. A fight I would love to see again, just because I thought the first fight was great. Him and Dominic Cruz.
Would love to see that fight, Jason. I went like sentimental because I feel really bad for Jimmy Rivera. I just want to see that man in a championship fight. That's why he's my pick. He's really freaking good. He's gone on quite a win streak. And in 2018, I want to see Jimmy Rivera get a championship opportunity.
Oh, I was looking ahead at the future UFCs, and I was looking at that Fox card in February, which I'll be at. And I was looking at who might be the main event of that fight card. Cody Garbrandt, Jimmy Rivera makes a lot of sense as a main event for that fight card.
Oh, I would love that so much. Probably not a big money fight, because Jimmy Rivera isn't a big money name, but that's a great fight. Jimmy has looked so awesome, and he deserves it, because like he totally ruined all of his holidays and his honeymoon for a fight that didn't happen, yeah. So I feel bad.
At featherweight, to me, the fight I want to see, Max Holloway, Frankie Edgar.
That's a great fight. I want to see that one. I'll go with Brian Ortega, Max Holloway one day. I think that's probably next if Ortega gets a win or things fall through with Edgar. Just Ortega Max Holloway could be a balls to the wall type fight that could go in any direction. And Ortega represents a fighter who can just win at any given second.
At 155 pounds, to me, it's kind of there's two parts to this. I want to see Conor Toney and then the winner fights Khabib.
Yeah, to me, that's the obvious answer. There really isn't a whole lot of fighters after that that you can kind of sink your teeth into. Looking forward to it. So Khabib, Tony are the answers. If you're talking about a fighter, maybe if things go right in 2018, don't discount what Ali Aquinta could do in 2018.
At 170 pounds for Tyron Woodley, there's three names I'll give you that are fights I'd be interested to see. Two from a sporting aspect, one from just the trash talk would be amazing. The ones from a sporting aspect, RDA and Kamaru Usman, and then, of course, the trash talking, we all know who that is. That's Colby Covington.
I love it, and neither of those – I love all three of those fights. Well, maybe not the Covington fight. I love the trash talking of that one, just not the actual fighting.
Oh, I want to see – roll right through him.
He would. I want to see Ben Askren fight Tyron Woodley.
That would be great. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, just for the love of God, I like having closure. I want to know how good Ben Askren is. So, and it's realistically could happen. Like, they could actually sign him. So that's why I put him there. But yeah, Usman, man, that guy, he flashes such high potential. This guy improves each and every time. A guy who I thought was a boring fighter when he was coming out of the Ultimate Fighter has become a great fighter who's incredibly exciting to watch.
185 pounds. The fight I'm looking for is a fight we're going to see in February, Whitaker and Rockhold. But kind of what you talked about a little bit earlier about really maybe looking ahead 10, 11, 12 months from now, Paulo Costa?
Oh, I love that pick too. He was the initial guy I thought of in that role. But the guy I landed on would be Derek Brunson. Okay. If he's able to score a few early round knockouts, he could really build some hype around him as just a dominating force. He's already pieced together two straight.
Okay, here's the hardest division, 205.
Oh, I saw it. Did you go Ilir Latifi? Did you go Gadzir Murad Antigalov?
Oh, man. I mean, I feel like this year we're going to see Cormier Gustafsson after Cormier beats Volkan. I mean, look, Volkan's got a puncher's chance in that one, but if he doesn't land that punch within the first 60 seconds, I don't see how he beats Cormier. But after that, man, oh my God. I mean, sentimental factor, Shogun?
Sentimental factor until the fight happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I went boring at this one. I just went with Alexander Gustafsson. Yeah. I would like to see him get a championship opportunity. But geez, yeah, doing this exercise made me once again realize how kind of lame light heavyweight is, but maybe Michael Oak can fix it.
Okay, they need John Jones to somehow get off on a technicality.
Oh my God, they certainly do. Yeah, John Jones is the real answer for this question.
Yeah. Heavyweight to me, it's easy. The winner, Miocic Ngannou, Cain Velasquez.
100% agree with you. Cain is the answer. Again, another division where looking forward, there aren't a whole lot of enticing long-term challengers, but Cain is without a doubt the guy I want to see get a title shot after Miocic takes on Ngannou.
At women's strawweight, I really want to see the rematch between Rose and Ioana.
At women's strawweight, I agree with you. After that, I think Carla Esparza is a fighter that could get a title shot, especially if Rose is still champion, just given that Esparza has a win over her.
I'm surprised they're doing the Andrade Torres fight.
Yeah. Why so? What are you surprised about that?
I don't know. I think that, if Ioana's not next for the title, I think you could have gone with Rose and Tisha as a fresh matchup.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though it would be their third fight, but I feel like there's a little storyline there, but I do feel they're going to go Ioana and Rose. I think the question is that a pay-per-view fight or maybe is that a main event of a Fox card?
It's a tough question. I'd probably be conservative and just put it on Fox.
Yeah. Try to build their names. But
yeah. I just think there's more potential there, especially because like you could see, one of the two, you could see Ioana kind of leave the division if she loses. So I would probably go that route, but I think it's a big fight.
Here's another tough one. Women's flyweight.
Yeah, it is really tough. But
I mean, here's a question. Is Nico Montano going to fight Eubanks next? Is that what the route they go?
Man, I understand Shevchenko already has a fight lined up, but to me, that would be sad. I mean, that's a fight that you just bury on a card.
Looking ahead, it would be Shevchenko Ioana for the 125-pound title.
Yeah, Joanna was my pick because I feel like Shevchenko's going to get the fight with the victory. And so after that, I think Joanna Jędrzejczyk is the fight I want to see in 2018.
At women's bantamweight, we mentioned about Nunez Cyborg as potential there. I think that's more at featherweight than bantamweight, obviously. But if Nunez's next fight is at 135, to me, it's got to be Raquel Pennington.
Yep, she was my pick as well. I just feel bad because of her accident. And I think she's almost back ready. I think she may fight, like she said, May. She may be ready or something like that. So Raquel Pennington's the obvious pick. Another division without a litany of challengers.
And let's go over to Bellator. We all know the heavyweight title. You know, we'll see who's going to win that tournament. I still do like Matt Mitrione to win that. Light heavyweight Ryan Bader. Obviously, time is going to make a lot of factors with that. I mean, the Kingmo fight would be the fight to do, but they're going to fight now at heavyweight.
I know. And I just really don't know who else a light heavyweight you can look at. I mean, because everything kind of feels so boring after that. Yeah. Like, it seems like we've seen the same.
Do you want to see Phil Davis, Ryan Bader again?
Yeah, it's just everything is repeating. I mean, I don't know. Maybe Wanderlei Silva can just return and, you know, win a couple fights, Jason. Not really. I don't know. I guess the fight I would look forward to the most would be if Liam McGarry ever figures out, like, all the issues in his game.
Yeah.
In the end of 2018, if he really improves, I guess that would be the pick.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. 185, to me, it's easy. Carvalho, Musasi.
Yeah. To me, Musasi is without a doubt, he's kind of the uncrowned champion at 185 and maybe 170 and maybe light heavyweight. I mean, Gegard Mousasi may have been the answer for the light heavyweight question, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, at 170, it's interesting. We got Lima and McDonald. You know, after that, you look at Michael Page, Larkin, Koreshkov. I'd probably, if McDonald wins, I wouldn't mind seeing him and Koreshkov.
Yeah, I would like to see McDonald against each of those guys, but the fighter I want to see get a championship opportunity just because he's been developing for so long would be Michael Page, to finally get him vaulted up against the best of the best, just to see how he would do undefeated Michael Page. I think that's my answer.
At 155, it's easy for me. Premise Chandler, too.
Yeah. It was so unsatisfying how their first fight ended that I desperately, out of any fight, I want to see Michael Chandler get a chance to reclaim his title, and hopefully nothing goes bad.
Yeah, at 145, I know it's a route they're going to go anyway, but the rematch of Pitbull, Patricio Pitbull and Daniel Vichel.
Yeah, I mean, if I have one goal at 145, it's just to see Daniel Strauss like doing good again. I mean, that was a brutal accident he got in. Yeah. I believe he posted a picture, he was standing up. So that's good.
Women's flyweight. Of course, Lemelia McFarlane. I think obviously the matchup they're going to do is Valerie Letourneau.
I think to me that's literally the only fight you can make that's interesting in that division. This division sucks. Yeah. Who do you have at women's featherweight, man?
Oh man, I don't even know what route you go there. I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. Is Talisa Noguera still under contract?
Yeah, I mean, she's the one that I think you'd probably point to. If Alexis Dufresne could make weight,
yeah.
But I don't think they'll put her in that title fight until she shows she can make weight.
Yeah, my pick would be Talisa Noguera. Yeah. But man, these divisions are bad.
Once again, goes back to the conversation we had a little bit earlier about Cyborg. You look at Bellator's struggles to develop a 145-pound division. You know, it's a tough division where there's just, you know, is it just a division that just is never really going to develop into, where a promotion can really have this solid foundation?
Yeah, it's a tough question to answer because I think you would have to lean towards. It probably won't in either promotion, but you never know. I mean, just an influx of fighters at that weight class could drastically change it, but it doesn't seem like those fighters on the horizon at all.
Yeah, but I do appreciate that question there from Gus Congo. Of course, always, if you want to submit a question or comment for the podcast, you can just simply tweet at me at Jason_Floyd. do appreciate all the ratings and reviews that we do get on Apple Podcasts. Would really appreciate if you give us a 5-star review. Really helps grow this podcast, so I really do appreciate that. But with that being said, we're now going to get into the interview portion of the podcast. And up first, you're going to hear my conversation with Calvin Kattar. It's going to be fighting here at UFC 220. Then you're going to hear my conversation with Jason King, Shamir Peshewa, and Blaze Gill. And following the interviews, we'll wrap up this week's edition of the MMA Report Podcast. I am now joined by a man that's going to have his second fight in the UFC come Saturday night, January 20th, UFC 220 there in Boston, Calvin Kattar. Calvin, as always, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. How's things been?
Things are going good, thanks. How you doing, all right?
I'm doing very good, man. Can't complain. Obviously, we're now into the new year. Since you have a fight coming up, is it one of those things with the Christmas holiday and the new year pretty much you're pretty low-key because everything is set on January 20th?
Oh, yeah, man. We're all business right now. Celebrate the holidays after the fight.
And, of course, you got the win in your UFC debut against Andre Feely. You were a betting underdog in that matchup. Is that something that even at all, like, does that bother you at all that people were maybe underestimating you heading into that fight?
Yeah, I always look for a reason to get a chip on my shoulder. That was, definitely a little bit more motivation and actually created a big opportunity for most of my buddies to make more money off the fight than I did. Crazy guys.
Now did they give you a little cut of that money? That's the big question mark. Like if they're going to Vegas and making a bet on you, shouldn't you get a little piece of that action?
I got a couple of champagne bottles splashed in my face after the fight. We had some fun, man. What a great opportunity that was. Shout out to Feely for taking the fight in that side, man. All good vibes going in and really happy the way things worked out. Now here we are.
I've talked to a lot of guys who they talk about these venues that it's like a bucket list item to fight in. Is the TD Garden, was that a bucket list venue for you to fight in?
I mean, that was always a huge, that was more like a dream come true, you know? Getting in the UFC was the bucket list. Fighting in the Garden is just a dream come true. You can't ask for something better than that. To go from Cali was awesome to fight in. Something I wasn't expecting. It was a complete surprise, and I was really happy to get that opportunity. But we asked for this one, and when we got it, man, what a feeling. And on top of that, to have my teammates Rob Font and Kyle Bochniak on the car with me, it doesn't get much better than that on paper.
I had a chance to talk to Kyle recently, and he talked about the advantages it is to be on a car when you've got your teammates on it as well. For you, what do you feel is the biggest advantage when you're on the same car with multiple teammates?
Just kind of more so than anything, I would say, obviously the physical work and all that, but just the mindset of going through it with your team and your coaches. We're all fortunate enough to go to the Performance Institute about less than a month ago for the fight. And it was nice breaking the camp. We're all able to go out there, lighten the mood, get some good work in at the top of the line facility. They got just what a great gym that is. It has the cryo chambers, PT. Everyone at that spot is very helpful. And on top of that, obviously knowledgeable and really the best of what they do. So it was just a cool opportunity. And having the team around you really just creates a good vibe leading into the fight. And that's all you really want. Things are going to happen one way or the other. You put in the work, but to have a good feeling, good vibes going in, it only betters your chances.
And I saw Tyson had put some stuff up on his social media about all the guys going out there to Las Vegas. And I've heard, various UFC fighters talk about just their initial thoughts of the Performance Institute. And it seems more than not, it was just an educational experience about, what can work better for your body, better ways to do things. For you, was there something that jumped out to you about just spending a couple of days there that maybe opened your eyes?
Oh, definitely. It was very educational. And I try to stay open-minded always and just critique my training and my nutrition as well as my rehab and all those things. I always try to stay open-minded to that because things change and technology is always improving and how to better train like an athlete of 2018 now, right? So things are always being modified, and they were very helpful and knowledgeable down there. They're still reaching out to us, following up. They care about their jobs. It was a great experience. And like you said, Tyson brought us out there. He's been a big help, just kind of putting things together, leading in. He's managing all three of us. So he's been coming, actually strength and conditioning, getting in the sweat with us. He's all in too. You think he has a fight coming up? Well, he has three, so he's working just as hard. And we got a good team thing going right now, man. The vibe's great. Fighting in our backyard, things couldn't be better on paper, and we're all excited to go, and ready to go out there to perform.
Do you feel additional pressure fighting in your backyard, or is it a mindset of like, look, no matter where I'm fighting, who I'm fighting against, there's pressure in every fight?
There's always going to be pressure no matter what, but you know, most people run from it. You got to run to it, and I'm excited to go out there. And like I said, the first fight for me was where the pressure I thought would have been, but the move is actually light. That chip on the shoulder really helped me dial in, focus on what I had to do. And this one, I feel like I'm just playing with house money. I already got that check next to the bucket list on the UFC fight. I'm having fun with this one, man. You know, it's in my backyard. I'm going to be in front of everybody I've probably ever met. And I'm excited about that. I've been working hard, and I'm excited to let my hard work and show my results. You know, I'm excited to go out there and perform. I really am.
Before you get this fight offer, were you aware of Shane?
So I had actually watched his fight with Charles Rosa. I thought it was a great fight. He had a nice late finish on that. He was down two rounds, I thought. I thought it was a nice win. Prior to that, didn't really know who he was, but I saw him. You know, Charles Rosa is a Boston kid, so I paid attention to the fight. And I was actually thinking the other day how it was funny how at that time I didn't know that A, I'd even be in the UFC, or B, that I'd be fighting him, you know, following my debut. So, hey, it is what it is. We're in the UFC. There's no easy fights, and I'm excited to go out there, man. I think he's gonna have a tough time. I think we have great style matchups. I think we're gonna go out there. We're gonna get the fans out of their seats, and I think it's gonna be a great fight for the fans.
Assess him as a fighter, and what, you know, you've talked about a couple of times why you're excited for this matchup, the style. You know, break him down, but also tell me why you're excited for this one.
Yeah, I mean, me and him got pretty similar styles, man. We like to stand up, we like to throw. That's what the UFC loves to see. The fans like to see, and I'm just happy to go out. And my last fight, I kind of felt like I had more to offer, more to show. But under the circumstances of 2 weeks and all the things that went in prior, I felt comfortable just going, you know, taking the W. But I did want to open up a little bit more. And that was on 2 weeks' notice. I couldn't have been better prepared now to have 10 weeks ahead of me in my backyard. This is, on paper, like I said, everything I'd want. And now it's just going out and letting it all go out there and all the hard work pay off.
And, of course, you mentioned about the nutrition aspect. Is that the hardest part of this game? Is just sticking to it and not, you know, kind of having that cheat day and making sure your weight's all good? Is that the toughest part for you about this game?
Well, I always get better at it. And as far as the way that works for me, I just know that in 19 days, I'll be eating good. So what's 19 days when, especially after the fight, when after a little hard work, it just tastes that much better after a nice W, working hard and almost like you earned it. You know, it's a good reset button on your life. Kind of get rid of the things that are good for you, you know, the distractions, and then you get to go right back to them after the fight. So I'm just excited. The first thing I'm getting after this fight is a nice round piece cutlet. I can't wait. It's my usual go-to after the fights. I'm 50 Italian, so I grew up on pasta and cutlets and all that. So okay. I'm excited to get a nice plate after the fight.
You know, obviously, with this being your second fight, you got to experience the early weigh-ins in your first UFC fight. You know,
yep.
And we've talked about how not just being a fighter, but also as a promoter. Do you like the early weigh-ins, or do you think that maybe that could be altered a little bit? Where I've always kind of thought of, why not have the weigh-ins maybe noon, 1 o'clock ish, as opposed to say 9 a.m.
As a promoter and as a fighter, you know, I like it both sides for myself. It just gives the guys more time to rebound from the weight cuts and go out and put on a better show for everybody. It shouldn't play too much of a factor in the fight, especially at this point now. You know, we're all professionals. Most of us, at least, you know, 15 plus fights, whatever the case is. at this point, we're pretty dialed in on our weight cuts, our diets, and how to get to where we are right now. So to go out there now and have that opportunity, you're not going to pass it up for a slice of pizza. You know, I like to hydrate properly. What's another day after weight cut? The old me would have, you know, gone to all you can eat sushi after stepping on the scale. Now I get the right foods in me. I eat the right things, and I celebrate after the fight.
Got to ask a final thing here. What's in store for Combat Zone in 2018?
Hopefully bring on better things. We're really excited about our upcoming event, February 17th. I got a lot of local talent on it, and I love being a part of the organization. That's where I got my start. I just like paying that opportunity forward to the local guys to get their shot. Like I did, you know, fight locally, and hopefully one day you put in the work long enough, you get your shot at the UFC. So we have some big fights coming up, some top level local talent that has been helping me prepare for my fight. I'm happy to get some of those guys on the card, and yeah, New England MMA is growing every year, man. I'm excited to be a part of it.
And of course, everyone's going to be able to see your fight coming up here January 20th, UFC 220 there in Boston. Of course, headlined by the heavyweight title fight. Stipe Miocic defending the heavyweight title against Francis Ngannou. Calvin, as always, man, I appreciate time. Let all my listeners know where they can follow you out on social media.
Yeah, it's at Calvin, Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter. Appreciate your time, man. Look forward to you talking on the next one. Maybe after this one, we'll get that W.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report on Radio Influence is a man that's going to be the main event of Valor Fights 47 coming on January 6th, live on Flow Combat. It is the Asian Persuasion, Jason King. Jason, as always, I appreciate the time. Of course, initially supposed to be in the co-main event, get elevated to the main event. When you get the phone call that you're now in the main event of the fight card, do you make any special calls to you know, friends and family to let them know you're in the main event?
You know, not really. It is an honor to be the main event. You know, I hate that the main event did get canceled, but you know, as far as, you know, my friends and family go, they don't care what, you know, where I fight at necessarily. They're just there to support me and, you know, to love me regardless of, you know, what position I fight in or what win or lose. You know, I do have a great fan base in the sense that they just support me regardless. You know, it is exciting for me personally though, just because, you know, being the main event, having that exposure, having said that, you know, you did compete for a main event fight, you know, that's definitely a blessing, and I'm glad, and I'm happy that Tim Loy, you know, thought that I was, you know, ready to do it. You know, it's I'm ready to go.
Is it a little more special that it's in Knoxville?
For sure. You know, Knoxville has been my home for the past, say 4 years now. So, you know, they've adopted me as the, you know, their Knoxville native, and you know, I'm definitely blessed to be, you know, to be here. To, you know, the whole reason why I came to Knoxville is to join, you know, Knoxville Martial Arts Academy, and you know, this is just another, you know, sign that's saying that, you know, I made the right decision. You know, I'm the main event, my hometown, and I'm ready to put on a show.
Of course, we did have a chance to catch up with you prior to the Border War show, which of course unfortunately did not walk away with a victory. As you think about where you were heading into that fight and to where you are now, what would you say are the main major differences?
Well, you know, that was a fight that, you know, it did not go my way. It was my first decision, period, win or lose. It was my first decision, and no disrespect at all to my opponent. He executed a great game plan against me. He neutralized me very well. But leaving that fight, I almost felt like I didn't get to fight. You know, his entire game plan was to stall me out. He did a great job of it. So, you know, whenever, I got back into it, we worked on not being stalled out. You know, I am an exciting fighter, win or lose. You know, I try to go out, you know, and then battle. And that was really the first time I've been neutralized to the point where I wasn't able to do that. So we went back to the drawing board and learned, you know, better ways in which to not have that ever happen again. Since then, I've not taken a week off from the gym. You know, I've been in there nonstop. You know, we have fights going on all the time, and anytime anybody has a fight camp, you know, I do my best to be there for their fight camps. So strength and conditioning, you know, MMA training, jiu-jitsu training, kickboxing training, all that stuff has gone through the roof now because, you know, for the past 7 months, I've been in a fight camp. So it's just given me that much longer and that much more hunger to prepare for this fight. And I'm so excited to finally be back in the cage. It's been too long.
You mentioned about strength and conditioning, and I was going to bring that up because, you know, as a producer of the Valor Hour, Frankie Padilla is a name that comes up a lot, and Frankie's Body Shop, and, you know, what he's done for a lot of fighters with Knoxville MMA. You know, I think a lot of people may have heard his name maybe through Ovin St. Preux, the fact that he was in Ovince's corner there back in November. But how is Frankie, from a strength and conditioning aspect, taking you to another level?
You know, Frankie... I guess I was the first one to go to Frankie, and more or less what happened was I bought a house two blocks away from the gym, and you know, I strolled in one day, I asked about joining the gym, and then a couple of days later I asked, you know, what kind of, I asked Frankie, you know, which one of your trainers do you think would best suit what I want to do, you know, as far as fighting goes, and he said, well, let me take a stab at it, and yeah, I've been hooked ever since, and now we've got like six or seven guys and girls at the gym now at Frankie's Body Shop under FBS Combat. And the reason why is because he understands what style of strength and conditioning is needed to fight. You know, during off seasons, during fight camps, he tailors things accordingly to, you know, where we don't get hurt or we don't get burned out. But it's always under the idea that, you know, a fight is organized chaos. It is, you know, it is technique, it is discipline, but it is also, I mean, it's violent. It's a violent sport. So you have to be able to do things and pull off things in positions that you may not want to be in. You know, you can't just do a bench press. You can't just do, you know, you just can't do, you know, your basic routines if this is what you want to do. You have to put yourself under duress. You have to put yourself through hell to know that you can get out of it. You know, and a big thing that Frankie does is he pushes not only our physical conditioning, but our mental conditioning. He'll tell us to do things that are just insane. Just through the roof, just like, you know, we'll have done an hour and a half workout, and then he'll put a 40-pound vest on you and say, do 100 burpees in under X amount of time. And all he's doing, he's testing you. If you break, you lose. And you know, that goes for training with Frankie. That goes for fighting. If you break, you mentally break in a fight, you lose. I mean, it's a done deal. So not only are we getting the physical conditioning from FBS, but we're also getting a lot of mental conditioning there. Just, you know, one more rep. I can always do one more rep. And that carries into the cage very well. And all my coaches at KMA, you know, Eric Turner, Joey Zoner, they take that and they translate that same ideology into fighting. And, you know, that's why I'm so blessed to be a part of both of those gyms.
Looking at your professional record, one of the oddities about your pro record is the fact of your very first pro fight was a no contest back November 1 of 2014, so just over 3 years ago. What do you remember about that fight, and kind of how did that help you grow as a martial artist?
You know, going into that fight, I was on like a 7-fight amateur win streak. You know, hadn't really had much adversity at that point, and I fought a guy, Judd Brown, who, you know, solid guy, and it was a good back and forth, you know, little fight there. I was prepared, you know, I was expecting to win, and I was prepared for a loss. But then you end up with a no contest, and you're just like, what do I do with this? So it was definitely an interesting way to start my pro career. You know, it was a back and forth affair. He got me with a couple groin shots, and I don't think they were intentional or anything like that. But my cup, I guess, during the process, had kind of been like skewed a little bit off center, and then the last one that he got me with just destroyed me. And it was really, looking back, it's funny, like the whole crowd gives you the slow clap trying to get you up. You try to get up because the crowd's giving you the slow clap, and that's what you're supposed to do, but your body's just saying, nope, we're done. So, you know, looking back, it's you know, there are smiles, there are regrets, there are things that I could learn from, but basically what it showed me was you know, you never know what's going to happen. You cannot control anything in the fight other than yourself. So, you know, I go into every fight now knowing fully that, you know, at the end of the day, all I control is me. And I have to do that to the best of my abilities every second of the fight, or, you know, the other person starts dictating. And, you know, I've learned from that. I've grown from that. And I've also bought a much better cup. So, Diamond Cup System, you have not sponsored me, but I talk about you every interview, so you probably should. So yeah, I got a better cup out of it too.
And now it's Stephen Haig. You know, they talk you talk about adversity, the things you have to do with getting through a fight, and the challenge that each fight brings. In terms of sitting around and waiting all day and all fight night for your fight to actually start, is that one of the biggest challenges of just, you know, making sure you're working, you're warming up at a proper time, and you know, you're not kind of a, you know, adrenaline's there where you want it to be by the time, you know, they announce your name?
I think had this fight happened as a main event, you know, even 2 or 3 years ago, yes, it would have caused, you know, some discomfort. I did, you know, my last amateur fight, I was the main event of the night, so I do have some experience being like the last one on the card. But, you know, as a professional, you know, and having teammates went out before you, the biggest blessing that I have in that situation is my coaches. You know, Eric and Joey, they've been doing this so long, and they know, they've probably forgotten more about MMA than I know, or that I ever will. So they know exactly when to get me started. You know, everybody at KMA has a different temperature, if you will. You know, some people on a scale of 1 to 10, they need to be an 8. You know, some people need to be a 2. I like, you know, staying right at like a comfortable 4 to 6 the entire night until it's time to go. And then when it's time to go, I'll start to ramp it up from there. And you know, Eric and Joey know me well enough and know the fight game well enough how to get me in different zones at the correct time. So, you know, being the main event, nothing I'm worried about. I will say that my favorite professional fight was actually my second professional fight, only because I was literally the very first person to walk out. And it took 10 seconds to win. And then I was like sitting in the crowd, like literally 5 minutes afterwards. And it was almost like the fight didn't happen. So like, it was pretty cool just being the first person out there. But you know, I got to enjoy that experience. Now I get to enjoy the experience as a professional being the last one out there. So it'll be fun either way.
Stevens, all of his wins have come by submission. Do you view his submission game as the best part of his overall game?
For sure. You know, he is definitely a submission specialist. He's a jiu-jitsu black belt. And I'm not going to take that lightly. You know, that being said, he's not necessarily bad anywhere. I mean, he has decent striking. People don't really talk about it because he is such a submission guy. And I feel like the same can be said about me in the reverse order. You know, most of my wins do come from TKO or knockout if you go as far back as my amateur career, but I do have submission wins. I do have a ground game. It's just not what I'm known for. You know, so I definitely think that Haig will, he will be submission hunting. You know, it's no secret that I like knockouts, but goes to the ground, it goes to the ground. You know, I'm not scared of his ground game by any means. You know, it's a good one. I have teammates that have good ground games. I have fought people with good ground games. If it goes to the ground, it goes to the ground, and I'm not going to be scared of it. It's just going to be one of those things where, you know, we know what he's good at, and we just we're banking that we know how to defend it. So, you know, I have a lot of respect for Steven. He's a great guy, and I respect his skill set. And you know, I'm looking forward to doing battle with him and being friends with him afterwards.
From a competitor aspect, is there all part of you that wants to beat him at his own game? You know, John Jones has talked about this, how he loves just beating guys at what they do the best. From the competitor side of you, is that part of like, man, you know what? I'd love to submit this guy.
Yes and no. I mean, as a competitor, I want to win. You know, as far as taking it to, do I care if it's a submission or not? Getting a submission win over Haig is not better to me than getting a knockout win or getting a decision win. You know, I don't like decisions, but you know, my job as a competitor is to win. Now, I think I can win in any part of the game. I think I can win in the wrestling game. I think I can win in the jiu-jitsu game. I think I can win in the striking realm, because at the end of this match, it's not any of those things. MMA, and anything can happen, and that's the beauty of the sport. I'm not focused on a specific win style on a specific round. None of that matters. I will, again, it goes back to being in control. I can't control Haig. I can't control anything in that cage other than me. You know, the ref in there, you might have a good night, you might have a bad night. Can't control that. Haig might have a good night, might have a bad night. Can't control that either. The only person I can control, in the cage and in life is me. So, that's all I care about. You know, I want to go out there and present to, you know, my coaches, my friends, my family, and all the fans out there. I want to present to them, and I want to present to myself the best version of me that they've ever seen. And that's what I gun for every single fight. So as long as I do that, I'll be happy and I'll be fine.
And, of course, it's all going to go down January 6th live on Flow Combat. Valor Fights 47. Jason, as always, man, I appreciate time. And let everyone know they can follow you out on social media.
Yeah, sure. That'd be great. My two busiest platforms are going to be Facebook and Instagram. If you want to follow me on Facebook, just look up the Asian Persuasion Jason King. I promise you I'm the only one on there. And then if you want to go on Instagram, I'm at AsianPersuasion_MMA. I do post different things on different sites. If you like dogs, I post a lot more dog stuff on Instagram. My Instagram actually started out as an Instagram for my dog, and I just kind of like shifted things over whenever things got more to the professional side of MMA. But yeah, follow me there. And before I go, I'd like to thank all my sponsors and gyms, Knoxville Martial Arts Academy, FBS Combat. Thank you guys so much. All my coaches and teammates. Thank you to 75 Clothing for being a fantastic sponsor. And also to Mad Tatter Studios for being with us from the beginning and being so great with people. Thank you so much. And thank you for the interview.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report on Radio Influence, Afire is going to make her pro debut on Saturday night, January the 6th in Knoxville, Tennessee. Valor Fights 47, Shamir Peshewa. Shamir, as always, I appreciate the time. You know, as you have gone through the preparations for this fight, any difference with this being a pro fight as opposed to an amateur fight for you?
Not really. The biggest difference is going back to 35. I did a couple fights at 45. Going back to 35, just more cardio, which is why I'm actually at the gym right now and on my phone instead of at home. So I'll be doing a little extra cardio, just getting those last little bit of water weight out. And I've got a week to weigh in, so I'm looking real good there. And that's the only big difference is less calories, more exercise.
And, of course, part of your story, anybody who follows you on social media, you're very active on social media and what's going on with you, a part of the gym life that you're a part of. And I was reading a story about you where it was talking about, your mission of Marvel Fitness is to break the stereotype of what fitness looks like. Can you kind of explain the stereotype you're trying to break?
I think a great image, if you want to have someone to look at, is Olivia Parker, who also fights that night with me and Jason King. She started with me. She was 326. Really just kind of lost her focus, lost her drive. And we had her athletic at about 260. You know, she could do the box jump. She could do everything that anyone smaller was doing. And I kind of build people as if they were all athletes. It doesn't matter. I have a 61-year-old woman who works at Children's Hospital, and for 61 years old, she's pretty spry. I don't think that fitness looks like 110 pounds and yoga pants, and it can look like that, but I want other people to understand that there's not a certain type. And I think that MMA portrays that sometimes with heavyweight fights and super heavyweight fights, and it can be pretty athletic. Some of it's not, but some of it is. You see it in shot put. You see it, you know, where there's big, strong women, CrossFit games, things like that. And people just underestimate themselves. And you kind of bring that power out of people and their whole life starts to change, not only physically, but it's very powerful when you realize that you can actually change yourself. And when you start to realize that, you just kind of explode with power. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I have 10-year-olds. I have 60-year-olds, it really doesn't matter. We're trying to change other people's ideas. So I'm launching a website in January after the fight for Marvel My Fitness, and it's going to have, instead of workout videos with only people who are your ideal fitness, you know, look of fitness, it's going to have everyone. We have young, old, gay, straight, undecided, everyone, and everyone, every religion, every skin tone, everyone. And we all work out together and we're all a team. And I don't really know anywhere else in the world where that exists.
And, you know, love of competition is obviously something every fighter has. Where did your love for competition start?
I would say that it started when I was very small. I was always very little when I was a little kid. And I wanted, in my head, I was 6'6", 300 pounds. You know, in my head, I was like a warrior. You know, like I was Lou Ferrigno from The Hulk. If anyone knows what that is, that's who I pretended I was. You know, that was my image for myself. So it's kind of always been there because I was so little. I was like, all right, I got to prove myself. I got to be in here with the big kids or be in here with the teenagers, and I got to, you know, kind of hold my own hunting and, you know, really anything. If somebody's like, oh, you can't do that, I'm like, I probably can. So it's always been there. Roller derby helped bring it out. And then the competition of MMA, just it's always something new. The sport's always evolving, so it's not boring at all. And there's always a challenge with yourself, with a new technique. I mean, anything.
With all the amateur fights you have, how, as you think about your amateur run, I mean, how would you describe it in a couple words?
Resilient. I've always fought tough girls. No matter what their record was or what their record wasn't, they've always been tough. I've never looked at a fight, and you know, there's one fight that they say I canceled, but they put us on a card without telling us, me and another teammate, Justin Fisher. They put us on a card, and then like 2 weeks out, we're like, oh, you're on this card. We didn't know about it. So there's one that says I canceled, but I've never canceled a fight. We did say, well, how are we supposed to fight if we didn't know about it? But I've never backed out of a fight. I've never canceled a fight. Earlier in the year was the first time that had happened, when I was supposed to go pro. And it was heartbreaking to me, because I was always really proud of myself that I wasn't the girl that backed out the week of, or, you know, and nicely enough, it was a month out, but I fought pretty busted up before, and they won't let you fight with a cast on. So I didn't get to fight, but, that was going to be my pro debut. But again, I just have to trust in God and know that wasn't the time. For whatever reason, he said, wait. So we fought another amateur fight, and we're going pro now. So it's here.
I want to go back to April 14th, 2014, your first amateur fight. What do you remember about that night?
Are you talking about Melinda Hill?
Yeah.
Because I think that was, okay, for some reason, I was thinking that was February, but it might have been April. It's been a while. I drove 4 hours or 4.5 hours to go to Virginia, where it was. I had never seen the girl. I'd seen one picture of her on the poster, but she had no social media. I had no idea who she was. Took the fight on a 11-day notice, I think it was. We get there, and you know, the weigh-ins are fine. Everything is fine. And when we were about to walk out, I had spent a lot of time with my coach, Joey Zonar. And I tell this story because I was really like probably too excited going into it. Nervous and excited are on the same level playing field, like one, you know, the spectrum. So I was really, really excited. And Joey stayed backstage to warm up one of my other teammates who were fighting. And Eric Turner, my head coach, was going to come out there. And I froze because I was like, I need Joey. I felt like somebody had like ripped away like every that you had ever had. And I kind of freaked out for a minute. And I always think back about that freak out, because it can never, no matter what it is, it will never be, it could be UFC stadium and you know, fighting for a UFC title. And I don't think I would ever be that nervous, because I didn't think I thought Joey was coming out there. So I completely like freaked out, and Eric was like, it's okay, we're going to go out here, we're going to have fun. And I was like, almost hyperventilating. I was like, are you serious? This is going to be awful. But we went out and we did it, and it was great. And it was over real quick. You know, bless her heart, she actually cried and asked me to stop. So I kind of was kind of confused. So I mean, I was like, ref, you know, in the video, you can actually hear me say, ref, I think she's done. And so, you know, there was some humor to be had there, but it was a good experience, because I was so high. I was like so excited and so super ready to go. And then it was like a wrecking ball. It was like, Joey's not coming out there. So I don't think that it could ever be like that. Cause that, you know, now they both come out there, and Joey's not been at some of them. Sometimes Eric hasn't been there, you know, and other people. And I you know, felt like, okay, this isn't as bad as that time. So it was a good experience.
You know, I get to talk to a lot of fighters, you know, a lot of male fighters, and we talk about their spouses of how they handle the fight. How does your husband handle when he sees you fighting? Is he just as nervous? Is he more nervous than you? Because I think that's part of the fight game we really don't hear about, especially on the women's side of how do their spouses kind of handle seeing, you know, their significant other inside a cage.
So, me and my husband met in jiu-jitsu class, for those who don't know that. So he really understands the grind, as most people refer to it. He understands the competition levels, and he does compete in jiu-jitsu. He won double gold at IBJJF Atlanta earlier in the year. So he gets that you have to work hard for this sport, and he loves MMA. He's a nuclear engineer, PhD, so he doesn't get punched in the head, but he does do jiu-jitsu, and he's incredible. I couldn't say enough good things about him. He does my weight cut. He helps me through everything. He helps me meal prep, but I'm very lucky, and I know that, and I tell him that every day, that I'm very thankful, because I see some spouses, and they have a really hard time with the fight game because they don't understand, hey, I'm going to go to the gym for 3 hours, and then I'm going to go home, and I'm going to eat, and I'm going to take a nap, and then I'm going to go to the gym again, and then I'm going to come home, and I'm going to eat, and I'm going to take a nap, and then I'm going to the gym again. So, and he just cheerleads me on through all of that. He has been in my corner a couple fights. I like being able, and he, not that he, like, coaches, you know, like, it's hard to listen to two or three people in your corner, but I like being able to look over at him in between rounds, and nothing's ever really that bad if you have three people in your corner that love you. You know, I mean, I don't know how people compete with, like, the anger or, like, all the hate or things like that. And, you know, they don't want, you know, they come out and they look real angry all the time. Like, I come out dancing and singing, and I'm excited to be there. So, and he runs with that energy and helps me carry on that. It's never, he tries to keep me level, and he tries to keep me where I need to be. If I look at him and I'm like, I'm way too excited right now, or if I look at him and be like, I'm about to fall asleep. So we kind of, like, regulate each other, but it's really phenomenal. But like I said, I know it's lucky. We can't all have, like, Eddie Alvarez wives. We were talking about that the other day, about people who just scream their heads off and, you know, be so excited when you're in the cage. And it's, you know, some people can find that annoying, but it's also like, someone loves you enough that they are going to be that excited for you, you know?
You mentioned about your corner, and anyone who listens to the Valor Hour on Radio Influence, they've heard the story of there's been a famous person in your corner that a lot of people would know as the WWE wrestler Kane, who's also running for public office in Tennessee. And you told this incredible story about how the toughest thing when he's in your corner is actually finding gloves that fit him. Is Kane going to be in the corner on Saturday night?
He actually has a wrestling prior commitment that he's pretty upset about. But you can expect it in the future for him to be there again. And I ordered some, like, triple XL gloves off of Amazon. So we're ready now. We're ready. But he's I have a lot. I'm very lucky, very fortunate to have a very good support group here in Knoxville. And not just Knoxville. I mean, I work hard through social media to have the background and the fan base that I do. And I've worked on that for the last decade, with roller derby and then MMA. So it's sometimes people will be like, well, how did you do this? And I'm like, well, I went and talked to people, and I connected with people, and I listened to them. When they sent me a message and was like, oh, you know, I think you're cool, I didn't say, like, okay, you're dumb. I said, oh, well, who's your favorite MMA fighter? And I tried to connect, instead of pushing it away. I embraced it from the beginning because I like that I have the support. Right now I'm at National Fitness and they support me. There's so many, Eddie's Health Shop, there's so many, like, local businesses who really have, like, supported me since my first amateur fight. And that's incredible.
And of course, you've got the pro fight here against Natalie King, January 6th, Knoxville, Valor Fights 47, of course, live on Flow Combat. I'm sure you have visualized getting the victory in countless different ways. But for you, an A-plus performance, what would that mean?
It would mean that I went in there, eyes wide open, and did my absolute best every moment. I can't ask for anything more. People say, oh, well, the decision went this way, or the decision went this way, or you won this one, or you lost this one. And it's really, it can't be about that in the long term. It just can't. I don't think you ever go anywhere, like towards the top if you focus on those things. I just focus it moment by moment. As soon as that cage clicks, it's the next moment. As soon as she comes forward, it's the next moment. Just taking it in and doing, if I can do my very best every single second, then I'm happy. No matter what the outcome is, if I can go in and perform my best, I'm not sure that I could ask for anything more than myself.
And of course, as I mentioned, I was able to watch this on Flow Combat Saturday night, January 6th, Knoxville, Tennessee. Valor Fights 47. Shamir, as always, I do appreciate time, and let everyone know where they can follow you out on social media.
If you type in Shamir and MMA, you're going to find me. I'm on Twitter. It's Real Hella Kitty on Twitter. Over on Instagram, it's Shamir Hella Kitty MMA, I think. Really, if you type in Shamir into MMA, you'll find me. If you hashtag combat couples, you'll find me. So come follow me. Follow my personal page on Facebook because I don't have a fan page yet, but I'm full on my regular Facebook, but you can follow it. So just type in my name, you'll find me.
I am now joined by a man that's going to look to claim the King of the Cage lightweight title cup here on January the 13th. It is Blaze Gill, who is 3-0 in his career. Blaze, I really appreciate time. How's things been, man?
All pretty good. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it, man. Of course, everything has gone extremely well for you. 10-0 as an amateur, 3-0 now as a professional fighter, but where did the love for MMA come for you? I know you were a high school wrestler. Is that pretty much just a foundation of it was kind of the next step of continuing that, athletic career?
Yeah. Growing up, I had some uncles and my dad. They were all very involved with boxing. And growing up as a little kid, it was kind of like, you know, Mom didn't quite like the brutality of boxing, so we decided to do a lot of wrestling. So and then, you know, from wrestling, it's kind of the natural progression. There is no, you know, there's MMA, it just falls right into it. So I kind of took that avenue and fell in love with it. And, you know, I took a little bit of a break, you know, in my early 20s to, you know, kind of figure out a career and that sort of thing. But, now I'm back at it, you know, chasing down a dream.
So when you decided that you were going to be a martial artist and, you know, take amateur fights and go to pro fight, what did your mom think when you told her that, hey, this is what I'm going to do for a career?
When I first came back about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, my mom got on board completely with it. And, I had my first fight back was out in Las Vegas, and I mean, she jumped right on a plane and came out, and that was the first fight she ever watched. I had 10 amateur, you know, 9 amateur fights before that, and she didn't want anything to do with it. But now that she sees that, you know, that I'm, you know, this is what I'm trying to do, she's completely on board, and I appreciate her for doing it that way, for being that way.
Since that was her first fight that she attended, did you at all feel like any additional nerves of like, oh my God, I better go out and do something here because mom's in attendance?
I think there was enough nerves just myself. You know, I was off for about 8 years from MMA. I mean, I still kind of went to the gym and rolled around a bit, but you know, as far as competition wise, I didn't compete. So, you know, the first time back just myself was like a lot of nerves, but now, you know, this last fight, my third pro fight, I was at a point where walking into the cage just felt like another day, and I just feel like I keep getting, you know, more and more comfortable in there, which is a good thing.
And when you step into competition next weekend, it'll almost be exactly 1 year from your first pro fight. That was January 14th. What do you remember about that night of your first pro fight? I mean, as you think about it now, is there anything that really sticks out to you?
I tell you what, that first pro fight was, it was a headache for me because, it's just about this time of the year when it starts getting really cold here in Iowa. And I got sick with the flu and a cold. And that week I was on antibiotics. And the whole time I was just kind of like, oh, my goodness, no, not the right time for this. And I finished my last day of antibiotics, the day of the fight. And I just remember warming up and just not having my wind where I wanted it to be. And even getting into the cage, it was like the first minute and a half, I was like, whew, this is, you're hurting here, bud. And it was kind of a grind, just from, you know, the mental standpoint of I had to really pace myself out in the fight. And then, you know, luckily within 2 minutes, 3 minutes, I kind of got a second wind and then fell into the pace of the fight and started to take over and come out the W.
They always talk about you're going to have to deal with adversity at some point. Would you say that's the kind of the biggest adversity you had to get through, just of, you know, hey, man, you're in here, you got to do this thing?
Yeah, I think that one was. That's probably, I've never kind of faced that dilemma before, where it's just, you know, you're not at your physical peak and there's some hindering you. I mean, most of the time you do have some sort of little bugaboo injury going into a fight, but something like that where it, like, you could completely tell that your wind is just gone, and going into a fight, that's kind of the worst thing, is not having the ability to have a good wind.
But of course, everything has gone great for you. As we mentioned, 3-0. Now you take on Jake Adams here for the title. Assess Jake as an opponent, and why you like this matchup for yourself.
Was not going into too many details of, you know, my game planning, but I do like the fact that he is going to be a good challenge for me, from the standpoint of he probably will be the rangiest opponent I've faced. At the 155 pound class, I'm 5'7", so I keep running into guys who are quite a bit taller than me, but I believe he's around like the 6'3 mark. So from a standpoint of that, just having to dictate, you know, where the fight's going to be and, you know, how to get inside, that sort of stuff I'm looking forward to that challenge, because everybody that I have faced has been taller as well. And so, you know, I've kind of come in with that mindset of taking that same approach. And I mean, we'll see how it goes. A fight's a fight. I won't, you know, once you're in there, you kind of learn to adapt and give what he's taking you. And so, I mean, from what I see, he's pretty good. He's going to be a pretty good challenge.
Is it one of those things, though, but for you as a competitor, it's, you have that mindset of like, look, you know, he's going to bring what he's going to bring, but this is ultimately about me and what I want to accomplish in the fight?
Yeah, exactly. You know, every fight that I've ever been in, I've never been into a position where I'm in a bad spot. I feel like every fight I've ever been in, I've pretty much from the get-go dictated the pace of the fight, where the fight's going to take place, and I see this one no different.
And looking on Tapology, it has your nickname as the Inferno, which obviously has to go with Blaze. What's the origin of the nickname?
Well, there was a woman by the name of Linda Conley, who passed away about 2.5 years ago from some cancer. And she used to watch me wrestle in high school and told me I was a little ball of fire. And from that, fire is just kind of with my name. It's always just kind of stuck around. And so with that, I kind of liked to, in the way I wrestled too, was just, I kind of always dictated the pace. It was always a high pace. So I kind of felt like, you know, I'm taking people to an inferno and just, you know, grind them down to their ash.
One of the things that would
keep that kind of mindset with, you know, with all these fights.
One of the things that was said to me about you and some background information is that you're about to have your first child. Has that at all changed your mindset of, you know, where you're at in your fight game as you think about the future at all?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, you know, you want to provide for your family and you still want to chase down a dream too. So, you know, this goes hand in hand. I'm doing this to build a legacy. I want my daughter to remember me or look up to me as, you know, something special. And, I feel like I'm setting the groundwork to do that.
Obviously, you're young in your career, but I'm sure you have set a lot of goals for yourself and things you want to accomplish as a martial artist. But as you think about over the next, 6 to 12 months, what are some of the things that you want to accomplish?
Well, for one, it's going to be winning a world title. And then from there, defending it and just building my legacy as a true champion. And, I just, one of the things where I want people to look back and go, wow, like it was something special, and when I'm done through my pro career here, I want to be able to look back and say, yeah, those were some good times. Some people say, you're crazy to jump in a cage like that and do it. But, there's a lot of love to it. There's some about the aspect of competition and, knowing that I'm in my late 20s, that time is there's a shelf life to it. So go out and make the memories that you can.
Of course, this may be the first introduction. Someone's listening to this. They were not familiar with you prior to this interview, but now maybe they're going out and they're Googling your name. They're trying to find fight videos. What would you want those people to know about who you are, not just as a fighter, but as a person?
Well, I feel like I'm a natural born leader, I've always, even from middle school age to wrestling, high school, college, I've always been someone that people have looked up to, not just from an athletic standpoint, but just as a person, as a role model. And, it's life's about, building those sort of interactions with people and just knowing that you live your life like you're a champion.
And of course, your fight is coming up here next week. King of the Cage, Blaze, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Where can all my listeners follow you out on social media? And who are some of the people that are helping you out to get through this fight?
You can follow me on at Blaze the Inferno Gill on Instagram. And I have a fan page on Facebook, Blaze the Inferno Gill. And I really want to thank my boxing coach, Brett Wong, my striking coach. He's really, I focus so much on my hands and my kicking and, just the stand-up game. As a wrestler, a lot of the ground stuff is so natural to me and the jiu-jitsu, but I really focus a lot on my hands, and he's really done a lot to get me into a situation where I'm completely comfortable taking the fight and standing on my feet, and if I want to take it to the ground, then I can take it to the ground.
And there you have my interview with Blaze Gill. Appreciate him coming on the podcast, talk about his fight coming up here for a title at King of the Cage. Also appreciate Calvin Kattar, Jason King, and Shamir Peshewa all coming on this week's edition of the podcast. We'll bring Daniel right back in. We're going to give you a preview here, a little bit of the next UFC fight card, which is on Sunday night, January the 14th in St. Louis, headlined by Jeremy Stephens and Du Ho Choi. This is one of these fight cards, a Sunday. Of course, I'll have a lot of a build up during the NFL playoffs, which of course start this weekend. But there's some fights on here that I'm looking forward to watching. Stephens Choi is one of those. To me, my number two fight on this card would be Kamaru Usman and Emil Meek.
Yeah, and it's all about Kamaru Usman. I mean, Emil Meek really was way more impressive than I originally expected in his last fight. So he's certainly moved up his stock, but Jesus, Usman is the A-side. Emil Meek's pretty tough, but there's a reason why Kamaru Usman is literally like a 500 favorite, which is tough to do against a tough fighter in Emil Meek at welterweight. So that fight certainly sticks out, Jason. To me, the main event is just the odds-on favorite to be the fight of the night. Du Ho Choi, Jeremy Stephens could be one of those kind of early fight of the year contenders we get. Not looking forward to a 13 fight card. This one appears to be incredibly long with a lot of commercials. But I also am very much looking forward to Uriah Hall and Vitor Belfort, just because I do think that one will end in the first round via knockout.
Yeah, I think that's a very good chance. I did see Du Ho Choi's got about a year until his mandatory military service does come up. So of course, we've seen that before happened, with Korean fighters, but looking for, that should be, I guess is that maybe that's the first one to drop me. Hey, we could have first round finishes and back to back fights there in the main event. In co-main event, also you got Paige VanZant taking on Jessica Rose Clark on that main card. You've got Darren Elkins and Michael Johnson. It's on that fight card as well. You got James Krause, Alex White. So it's you know, it's kind of become this staple in that UFC calendar in January, where they do an event on a Sunday following NFL football. Of course, that'll be you know, the what's that, conference semifinal weekend. You know, which of course the playoffs take place this weekend. So that of course we'll be previewing this fight card more in depth next week, as that'll be the first UFC event. And then the following week we get into January 20th, a big night in MMA and also in boxing. A lot of stuff going on there. Really looking forward to UFC 220. Also looking forward to Bellator 192. Got any big plans this weekend, Daniel?
Just watching fight tape, Jason. Nothing too exciting. I'll just working Vipers and whatnot. And yeah, I will say, just to close things out, I think late December is like the perfect date to do a UFC event. The more and more I think about it, like December 30th is just the greatest date ever. Because I noticed working all my RGV Vipers, I also work a wrestling show, some soccer, etc., that the crowds for each and every event I worked for this weekend were way bigger than any of the crowds. And it's only because people are out of school and they're with their families. And they're just looking for things to do and spend their money on. So, you know, the buy rate for UFC 219 may not be great. It's probably higher than I expected. But moving forward next year, if you're UFC, you got to look at the calendar. Late December is when you do a big show, because I think people are just looking for things to do.
Yeah, I mean, they always try to do those big shows. I mean, when I walked Dave and Buster's, it was a huge crowd. I mean, obviously, you know, probably, you know, less than 40% of the crowd was there to watch the UFC event. But, you know, there was some interest based on some of the other factors that I'm aware of. So I think that's always a good thing. That buy rate will be interesting. Does it get more than 250,000 buys?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, before on the previous show, I thought it was going to do Demetrius Johnson level. But my initial thought after the conversation regarding the card is I think it's going to be around 200,000, which is better than I thought. So we'll see what the real number is down the line. But it'll be really interesting to tell the UFC where they're at when it comes to Cyborg as a draw.
Yeah, very telling. For that. But that is going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast. Of course, if you're not subscribing to this podcast, you can do that Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play. Of course, myself and Daniel will be back next Wednesday as we're going to get you ready for that UFC Fight Night card in St. Louis. Plus, we'll talk about everything else going on in MMA. So, for Daniel Gavon, I am Jason Floyd, and you have been listening to the MMA Report podcast on RadioInfluence.com.
Here is Kevin Kennedy and Rich Herrera with an Inside the Dugout Quick Fix.
All right, let me run through these rapid fire and just get your comment, and we'll move on through all these stories. Carlos Santana signing with the young Philadelphia Phillies ball club. Good move, bad move?
Good move. They've got a good young ball club overall. They got a couple of starting pitchers that I like. They've got a decent guys at the end of their bullpen with Maris at the end. Gomez is there as well. And I saw that their offensive guys have got some good pieces. Freddie Galvis, of course, is gone now, but that's a big bat in that lineup. And of course, with Santana, he's got more power from the left side than the right side. That ball jumps in Philadelphia, so that's a good move for them. And Gabe Kapler, of course, is going to do things outside the box, and that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Zach Britton blows his Achilles tendon. They said that he's going to be out maybe till June. I think that's real. I mean, that's 6 months. That's really optimistic. Do the Baltimore Orioles need to go out and replace him? Or if I'm going to deal Manny Machado, do I have this complete rebuild right now going?
I think they've got to go out and try to replace him and be competitive again. It's going to be hard for me to see Buck Showalter and Dan Duquette not want to be competitive. I know both guys, especially Dan. I know him well. And losing a guy like Britton, that usually an Achilles like that usually takes a year to heal. Rick Monday had that injury. Told me he missed a year. I had an injury. I didn't have it torn, but I was out several months a few years ago. I mean, I was limping for a long time. Nomar Garciaparra told me he had Achilles tendonitis, for crying out loud, and was hurting throughout his last year with Boston, couldn't play. So for a pitcher to have an Achilles tear, and I read that it's, you know, they said the doctors explained it wasn't as bad as normal tears. It's getting a little technical, and I won't get into that part of it, but they said that's why they estimated it could only be 6 months, maybe 8 months. But my guess is, if you're the front office there and you're Dan Duquette, my guess is he's got to assume that Britton won't be back this year.
Tim Lincecum wants to work out, wants to try a comeback. Would you go take a look?
Yeah, you got to take a look. What else have you got to do? That's what your job is as a major league team, one of 30 teams. Why not take a look? You never know. Everybody needs pitching in today's game. And then especially bullpen. If he wants to be a bullpen guy, I don't know about starting. But actually, he could be a starter today because a lot of starters only go twice around the lineup. So who knows? So, you know, I've seen it before where guys could come back and they don't throw hard anymore, but they learn how to pitch with their off-speed stuff. So I think it's your job as a front office and as a scout, you know, to go out there and take a look and say, hey, no, there's no way he comes back. Or say, you know what? We'll give him a look. Why not?
The Brewers signed Joely Chacin for a 2-year deal, about $8 million per. So now we know what the market is this offseason for a number 3-4 starter in the big leagues.
Well, they lost one of their starters. They got hurt last year at the end, the Brewers, and they had 3 really quality starters. This is a good move for them because they've got a nice core offensively. They got a playoff caliber team. They should be good again. And I saw Chacin come all the way back with your team, Rich, the Padres. I was shocked how good he was. I thought day one when he was the opening day starter, I thought, oh, man.
But we saw him. He got lit up.
He got lit up, and I thought, oh, man. But he came back. He was throwing strikes. He was one of the best pitchers in the National League last year.
Yeah, absolutely. I was surprised he didn't get dealt training deadline. That's how well he was throwing.
Strike after strike, changing speeds, really knew how to pitch, and he showed that he was healthy. So because years ago, before he got hurt with Colorado, he was considered a number one or a number two. Remember? I mean, but last year I thought, boy, the Padres, that's tough. That's your number one, especially after I saw him opening day. But at the end of the day, he had a great year, and it's a good move by the Brewers.
Inside the Dugout with Kevin Kennedy and Rich Herrera can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and RadioInfluence.com.